From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're lucky enough to have Michael Lewis. Michael really needs no introduction. He's one of the best-known writers, journalists, and authors in the country, perhaps even the best-selling journalist and author today. His books have become best-selling, frankly, blockbuster movies, like Moneyball and The Big Short. And I want to thank you personally, Michael, because my son has watched Moneyball about 30 times, including during the quarantine. So thanks so much for providing some content to keep him busy. Michael also wrote a book called The Fifth Risk, which is focused on the transition from President Obama to President Trump and some of the problems in that transition. And his book highlights the work of career civil servants, an apolitical group of individuals who serve our country with grace and distinction. Today, we're going to talk about his book, The Pandemic, and Government Planning. Welcome to the podcast, Michael, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let me just start. You're in Berkeley. I'm in D.C. How are you doing? And how's your family? And how's your high school senior coping with losing her senior year?
It's a little hard dealing with the shrinking of our world and having everybody together in the house, but not that hard. It's a delight. We have three kids. They're all back. Our college sophomore is back. But now that the saddest thing that's happened, though, is indeed the senior in high school losing not just the end of her senior year, but she was in the middle of her what was going to be a glorious softball season. And there's a chance they're going to come back in May, but it's not the same. And she was whooping it up when in the early part of the season. So we're sad to have missed that, have lost that. But if that's all we lose, we're very lucky.
I agree with you. I have a senior, and she was wanting to have social distancing from her family, but instead she's got the opposite, but we're coping. I want to start with a dinner we had last December. You were nice enough to come to our house and speak to a group of people interested in government effectiveness. And I remember the first question I asked you, which was, geez, Michael, you've gone from hanging out with MLB players and Brad Pitt to writing about the Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture. That's pretty boring, isn't it? Today, that doesn't seem so boring.
It didn't even seem boring at the time. I mean, I wouldn't have written about it if I thought it was boring. And yes, it's become even sort of more pertinent and on the top of people's minds. But I think anybody who walked into the transition that I walked into as a writer would have found it interesting and would have had the problem I had, which is you kind of don't want to stop because the federal government's so big and there's so many things going on inside it that seem so critical.
Well, everybody that's experiencing this shutdown from the pandemic should read your book, The Fifth Risk. But for those who haven't read it, what is The Fifth Risk?
The Fifth Risk itself, well, I would tell you how I came on the title, and that will kind of explain the title.
Please.
I was interviewing the person who was in charge of risk management inside the Department of Energy, which was the first department I had kind of walked into. His name was John McWilliams. And he was just appalled that nobody had really even debriefed him at that point. And this was, you know, almost a year, 9 months after Trump had taken office. And that the transition hadn't basically happened. So the people who'd come into the Department of Energy had no sense of what there was to learn from the people who had gone out. And he was one of them. And so I asked him, I said, all right, give me the top five risks that I need to worry about if you're the chief risk officer. And he said, you know, well, one, a nuclear weapon going off when it shouldn't go off. Two, the Iran nuclear deal falling apart. Three, North Korea is on its way to getting a missile that's could hit us. I'm really worried about that. Four, the electric grid being attacked or compromised in some way. It's constantly under attack, and we don't really have good defenses for it. And then five, and then he paused, and he couldn't think of one, and it took a while. And finally, he came up with one. He said program management, which was it sounds dull, but actually isn't. It's long-term programs that actually, if they are mismanaged, end up creating catastrophe. But actually what he's told me was you get to a point when you're thinking about risk where you can't think of what the risk is because it's not top of mind. You're not paying attention to it. And I thought, aha, that's the risk. The federal government is this manager of a giant portfolio of risks, many of them potentially catastrophic. And most of us aren't thinking about most of those risks most of the time. And it's the ones we're not thinking about that are going to cause us the biggest trouble.
And so what's your observation on the linkage to your book and the pandemic that we're experiencing today?
Well, it's funny. When I was wandering around talking to people and thinking about what I wanted to write, I came so close to writing about the risk of pandemic, but I thought I had two thoughts about it. One was, it's too obvious. Like, this should be top of mind. I had interviewed Obama at one point, and I asked Obama, and this was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what's the catastrophic risk that worries you the most? And he said, without missing a beat, probably disease, probably pandemic. And so I thought this was, so it was a little too obvious. I thought, so, and I was looking for less obvious risks. And two, the infrastructure in the government that has to deal with pandemic is so complicated and cuts across so many agencies, it was going to be hard for me to reduce it to 80 or 90 pages in a book. I didn't take that particular risk head on. However, having seen what we've seen in the administration's response to this, and in particular, having seen now, having we've had exposed the fact that the pandemic response infrastructure was treated just like all the rest of the government by the transition and by the administration. You know, I think, my God, it's a natural chapter in the book and probably the first chapter in the sequel. And you know, even now, I think the American people are only partially aware of what the government might have done if it had been properly prepared.
In every crisis, there are heroes. In 9/11, there was the firefighters and the policemen that went in and saved people, and then the recovery workers. In this crisis, it seems to me there are two heroes. One is the government workers, the people that are working to execute the plan to save the country. And two are the healthcare workers who are basically putting their lives at risk to save other people. When you were writing about government workers, I mean, it seems like a boring subject to write about people that work in the government, and there are stereotypes about them as bureaucrats and slow moving. What were your observations when you met people that were longtime career federal officials?
Well, you're giving me like an overhead, a shallow lob to smash there.
That's the goal of these, right?
Yeah, yeah. So because I don't write a book if I'm not energized by the characters I'm meeting. And I had as my hook that the Trump administration had not bothered to show up for the transition, had not bothered to show up for the briefings that were there to be had from the permanent civil service. And so I had to go get the briefings. So I had to get to know these people who were their subject experts. In some cases, there were people who had left the government. In some cases, there were people who were Obama appointees. In some cases, they were just permanent civil service. And to a person, they were extraordinarily mission-driven, extraordinarily focused, and a little myopic, but passionate about the thing they cared about. And they were all, to a person, moving and important characters, and easy to make swing on the page because they cared so much about something that mattered so much, to which much of the country was completely indifferent or oblivious. So I thought of them as sort of our greatest patriots. It was as if you had a military that was off fighting and dying in our wars without anybody acknowledging it. That's how they felt to me. An unacknowledged, very patriotic, in the best way, sort of army of people who were there for a variety of reasons. And almost, I mean, I'd say to a person, these were all people who could have made multiples of the income they were making working for the government in the private sector. These are not people who were there because they couldn't get a job anywhere else. It wasn't anything like that. So what I would say is, if you think you know what a federal government worker is, you know, maybe you think again. When you actually meet the people doing the jobs, you think, thank God they're there.
Well, one of the amazing things about your writing is how you create drama around characters. Very few people would know who Billy Bean is today, but for your writing. So there's a fellow in your book named A. Arthur Allen, who was a longtime career employee of the Coast Guard. How did you pick him and what was his story?
So here's a perfect example of everything I just said. We will illustrate it with Arthur A. Allen. When the government shut down December and January of last year, I thought, knowing what I knew about these people, how extraordinary it was that hundreds of thousands of them were being told they were essentially non-essential workers and sent home without pay. And I called the Partnership for Public Service and I asked, give me a list of everybody who's nominated for one of your SAMMY Awards, Distinguished mm-hmm. Government Service Awards. Just send it all to me, and I'm going to pick one of these people to write about. And it was hundreds of people. I mean, you know, they were kind of it was a grab bag of people. So I just grabbed the first name on the top of the list because it was alphabetized, Arthur A. Allen, and said he worked in the Coast Guard, and called him up.
Literally, the way you picked him was he was the first of the alphabet.
He was the first on the first on the list. I thought, well, mm-hmm. it's as good as random. And he was surprised to hear from me. He said, you're the first person who's ever called me from the media. And
he knew you were a famous author?
He had saved that question because okay. I don't know what he heard. I told him that I had written this book called The Fifth Risk, and I was going to write a long piece for the paperback that was going to come out in a few months, and I wanted to talk to him about it. But what he heard was, I saw you were nominated for a SAMMY Award, and I want to talk to you about what you do. And heard nothing more than that. Now, Arthur A. Allen, what had he done to deserve to be on this list? And he was indeed at home, deemed inessential, not being paid, told that he wasn't important by the society. He had been a young oceanographer, gone to work in the Coast Guard in the mid-70s, and had pretty narrow responsibilities. But as the only oceanographer in the search and rescue division of the Coast Guard, started to find himself being asked questions that, well, if he didn't know the answer to them, nobody did. And a lot of these questions had to do with the movement of the water in the ocean, the drift of the ocean, and how specific objects moved in the ocean. Because when the Coast Guard went to look for people who, I don't know, were on a capsized 14-foot sailboat, they kind of knew that capsized boat moved differently than, say, I don't know, a Cuban life raft would. And you needed to know how an object drifted to predict where it might be. And so Arthur A. Allen is kind of aware that this is a problem. And then he's invited to watch a day in the field with the actual search and rescue people, which was supposed to be a mild day. He was just going to observe their technology. And he was down in, I think, Norfolk, Virginia. And all of a sudden, a squall comes up and just out of nowhere. And the Chesapeake Bay is havoc. Its boats are being lost. People are calling for help from the Coast Guard. And he watches over the course of 12 hours a sailboat that has three adults and a little girl on it first go missing and then not be found until 12 hours later they find the little girl and her mom dead of hypothermia and the other two almost dead, in a place where they never guessed they would be. And they'd spent hours and hours looking where the boat wasn't because they didn't know how the boat drifted. So when I go to see Arthur Allen in his house and he's explaining to me how he drifted into becoming the world's expert on how objects drift in the ocean, when he's telling me this story, he pulls from his bookshelf a yellowed clipping from the local newspaper in Norfolk, and it's the story of this little girl and her mom dying, and he starts to cry. He says, that could have been my wife and daughter. He said, right then I said, I'm going to figure this out so this never happens again. And he starts to freelance, to just devote himself. He lives in Connecticut, so he starts throwing objects into the Long Island Sound and measuring very precisely how they drift. In a couple of years, he's got a catalog of hundreds of objects, and he writes the code when he's done. If you're a Coast Guard search and rescue guy actually on the job, you hear that, you know, some object is lost at sea, a fishing boat. And you pull up Arthur's page and you pick the nearest object that he's measured, and it kind of tells you how it might have moved. And in the weeks after he rolls out this new software to all of the Coast Guard search and rescue divisions, the Miami office gets a call. And the call is, a man has basically run off the side of a Carnival cruise ship 80 miles east of Miami, and he's floating in the ocean. And we know when he went off. We didn't find out for a couple hours, but we have cameras on the ship, so we know exactly where we were when he went off. And we also know that he's, you know, 5'10" and 300 and something pounds. He's obese. And Arthur Allen had studied big fat person in the water. And that person in all of human history would never have been found. Never. It's a needle in a haystack. They pluck him out of the water alive 7 or 8 hours later, and all the stories are written. Miraculous rescue. No one writes, Arthur A. Allen saved this man's life. But Arthur Allen's work has saved thousands of lives of Americans lost at sea, and it's not a trivial subject. Coast Guard will tell you that every day, on average, 13 Americans go lost at sea and 10 get rescued. I mean, it's not a trivial deal. And this man is responsible for a lot of those saved lives. So there you have inessential government worker who, now the punchline is, you ask me, famous author, what do you think he was going to get out of talking to me? I spent 3 days with him, 3 very full days. I was in his house. I met his wife and children, kind of interviewed them, went to meals with him. He took me back to his old office. On my way to the airport, on my way out of town, I get a text from him. And it says, hey, you're an author. Like, why didn't you tell me? And I said, what do you mean? He says, my son says you wrote a book that was a movie. And I said, well, what did you think I was doing there? He said, I thought you just wanted to learn all about search and rescue.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious.
Now, that is a very, very government worker story.
Yes.
They aren't thinking, what's the spin? What's my media presence? What's my brand? They're not thinking anything like that. They're thinking,
right,
I do this job. I want to teach people how to do this job. And the great sadness in Arthur Allen's life was the government had never given him someone to train to replace him. And so he walked out of his office and left all that expertise behind.
So let's turn to the subject of transition, which is the subject of the book, The Fifth Risk. So we are taping this in late March. It appears that Joe Biden will be the nominee, although Bernie Sanders is still in the race. So having written a whole book about transition, spent a large chunk of time on it, what advice would you have for the Biden team on what they should be doing and how seriously they should take a transition planning effort?
It should be the number one priority, especially given what we're living with now. And who knows what crisis might emerge between now and then? I mean, you may be dealing not just with the resurrection of a virus and a pandemic, but things on top of that. So the tool our society has to deal with these problems is the federal government. And you're going to be handed a crippled organization, an organization that has, not just through the Trump administration, but through many administrations, been allowed to age, has not been managed all that well, has been hamstrung in various ways. And a lot of people have retired. People who are not subject matter experts have been put in places that require subject matter experts. So what I would say is the biggest thing you're being handed right now is this giant toolbox. A lot of the tools are broken. Some of the tools are missing, but it's all you got. And you can fill that toolbox up pretty quickly if you're ready to go on day one. So the advice I would give them is, one, make it a huge priority, the priority. Two, no partisan litmus tests for most jobs. Instead, the filter is not, are you Democrat or Republican? The filter is, do you know what you're talking about or don't you? Do you understand the subject? Do you have management ability? So finding the right people and have them all ready and kind of try to get them, if you could arrange to get them confirmed or have agreements with the Senate beforehand, this is my list, start thinking about this so you speed up that process. I think what I'd also do is I would have a plan in place to present to Congress to overhaul the management of the federal government, to make it easier to hire and fire people, for example, make it easier to pay people well. One of the problems we're seeing in the Center for Disease Control is I think the top salary is like 180 grand. And those jobs, the people who are qualified for those jobs can make 10 times that in the private sector. So you've got a problem of not being able to pay the people who can do the jobs. I would identify up front what those problems were and not wait a year to address them. I'd have a plan to try to address them on the first day. And you might, in this environment, have a sympathetic Congress. If a Congress has watched the administration bungle a pandemic and watched millions of Americans get sick and thousands of Americans die who otherwise might not have, they might be more sympathetic to the argument that this whole enterprise needs to be reconsidered.
All right, well, let me ask you an opposite question, which may shock your sensibility as someone from what I used. I grew up there, the People's Republic of Berkeley. You and all your friends probably can't even contemplate the concept of a Trump second term. We're a nonpartisan organization, and we're focused on government effectiveness, whoever wins. So what advice, Michael Lewis, would you have for Donald Trump and his team were they to win a second term?
It's the same advice. They just won't take it. If you rolled me into Donald Trump's office and told me, look, you're not going to get anywhere if you offend him, so you should even suck up to him if you want to get him to pay any attention, what could I say that he might hear? Mm-hmm. And I think what I could say is the second part of that. Look, it's so sad that you got handed this artifact from the 1940s and 50s, our federal government, where you can't get the top talent in, where you can't fire people and hire people like you should be able to. There's a basic structural problems that are not your fault at all. It was all there before you got there. And now you can say, look, one of the problems we've had in managing this horrible crisis is just the structure of the government. Let's address that. So I think that part of it they might be able to hear and do something about because it isn't threatening to him. But beyond that, I don't know.
Well, let me ask you this. You've worked closely with the Partnership for Public Service, Max Starr. You wrote about him in your book. What are your observations about the role the partnership plays and why its role is important?
You know, if the partnership didn't exist, you'd have to invent it right now because somebody who holds an organization that is genuinely bipartisan or nonpartisan, whose sole interest is in making the federal government work better, there's nothing else like it. And you know, what was intriguing to me is that Max starts with a very narrow ambition years ago. And the narrow ambition is, how do we get bright young people to want to work in government? But that naturally leads to the broadest ambition, because to get young, bright people to want to work in government, you have to make the government a place where young, bright people want to work. So it ends up being a broad government reform effort. And there's no other place that is doing this with the same level of energy. And in addition, there's no other place that has such a positive appreciation of the government and is doing whatever it can do to raise the stature of people who work in government. And the partnership it's like a place where, first, the conversation can happen. Second, it's a safe place where government workers can come and learn and share frustrations. And third, it's sort of like it's like a little lab for how you fix the problems. You know, when I stumbled into it, when I first started writing The Fifth Risk, I was elated because I thought it was kind of one-stop shopping for anyone who wants to get to know their federal government. And the enterprise is so complicated and so vast, you really need someplace like that to organize it for you.
Well, Michael, let's close with a lightning round. You had no idea I'm going to do this, so let's see how quick you can be, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So during a pandemic, would you rather hang out with Brad Pitt, who starred in Moneyball, or Steve Carell, who was in The Big Short?
Steve Carell.
Why?
Just, I think, the distraction of all the single lonely ladies banging on Brad Pitt's door, I just think it would be too much.
Okay. The best book someone should read during this downtime?
I'm reading it right now. It's Amor Towles's novel, A Gentleman in Moscow, and it's about a Russian aristocrat who's confined for his lifetime to a single hotel.
Best movie that's not a Michael Lewis movie someone should watch during this downtime?
Lawrence of Arabia, just because it's the best movie ever made.
Your advice to reduce tension with your family when everybody's confined in the same house or apartment?
Tell everybody there's a rule, no judging. No judgment, no judgmental tones, none of that. There's always judgment in a family. People are always getting on each other about little things they do. Let everything slide. This is a period where we're going to let everything slide.
And what's the subject of your next book? You can reveal it here on Transition Lab.
Well, I don't know because I have one half written and I can't tell you what that is. But that may come out first, but it's quite likely the sequel to The Fifth Risk.
Okay, well, look forward to collaborating with you on that, and thank you for your work. Michael Lewis, thank you for everything you've done. Thank you for your entertainment, for your storytelling, and thank you for being with us on the Transition Lab.
Nice talking to you, Dave. Thank you so much.
Just a reminder that we invite guests with many different political views on Transition Lab. The views they express are theirs and not the partnership's. If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.